From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
If ever there was a time to build a new women's movement as a kind of phoenix rising from the ashes of toxic radical feminism, that time is now in our post-Roe gender-fluid America. That's the case made by a legal scholar and author, Erica Bakayaki. Erica's a wife, a mother, a Catholic. She's the mother of seven, and she's also a doctor of law. And today she shares her story and scholarly insights. Then we turn to the ongoing crisis of Christian Armenians who continue to suffer persecution. Former U.S. Ambassador of International Religious Freedom, Samuel Brownback, renews his call for global awareness and action so that governments like Azerbaijan can't continue to oppress people of faith. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency. I'm your host here on Register Radio. I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen, who is EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. So as we celebrate Mother's Day, we celebrate the God-given capacity women have for motherhood. That is physically to nurture life within their bodies and spiritually to care selflessly for vulnerable others. So society has made strides in recognizing women's unique contributions, but we've also blurred the lines of what it means to be a woman. Our guest, Erica Bakayaki, has studied feminine theory, law, and her Catholic faith. Her most recent book, published in 2021, is The Rights of Women: Reclaiming a Lost Vision, and offers legal and political arguments in favor of pro-life and pro-family feminism. So in a Register profile, we had an author who recognized that Erica, many people might find Erica kind of a contradiction of attributes. She's pro-life, she's Catholic, she's a feminist intellectual, and she's respected by academia. But she's also the mother of seven. These are things that don't often go together. So we welcome Erica to Register Radio. Erica, so good to have you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
So as I mentioned, this profile kind of shows that in a polarized culture like today, where we sort of think in opposites and everybody has their stake and their opinion and there's not much middle ground, you seem to represent a middle ground as a pro-life Catholic feminist intellectual. It's a beautiful thing. But what is your story? How did you come to be a Catholic pro-lifer and a feminine legal scholar?
Yeah, well, the story is sort of an interesting one. I actually had the opportunity to publish it as a chapter in Robert George and R.J. Snell's book, Mind, Heart, and Soul, if anybody wants to read kind of the full account. But my mom was married and divorced three times. By the time I reached my 19th birthday, I suffered two friends taking their own lives around that time as well. And so, as you can imagine, as a young girl with a lot of sort of emotional devastation in my life, I turned toward drinking and some experimentation with drugs myself. And you don't have to hear all the details, but I landed actually in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 17. And from there, when I got to college, I ended up at a really good college. It's kind of probably just from I was a really good soccer player. So maybe that's why. But I was a decent student in high school despite all that. But So I made my way into women's studies classes right away and really became one of the leaders of the Women's Center there. So I sort of turned, even though I wasn't drinking and drug anymore, I was playing soccer and all this, I really turned intellectually into feminism and really found there, because I hadn't met Christianity yet, really found there a lot of what I thought were answers to some of kind of the quandaries and puzzles I had in my life. From there, though, I ended up having a rather significant religious conversion, started, sort of morally as pushing back against sort of the actions I'd taken that were really difficult for me emotionally as a teenager. But then, having had that spiritual experience in AA and then starting to read and be pushed more by some texts, I came to embrace the Catholic faith actually while in college, kind of amazingly. I mean, some kind of key players that, that interview with me in the Register talked about, Helen Alvarez was really important. So was Marion Glendon's work. The Catholic worker movement was important there, but so was reading ancient philosophy. My parish priest, I'll say, just became named as a bishop-elect in Burlington, Vermont.
Wonderful.
Father John was then the parish priest at Middlebury, was really influential, and that played a big part in my conversion.
It sounds like, you know, people living out their Catholic faith, both in word and deed, and being strong intellectuals really played a part in that, Erica. And I think that's so important because, you know, we live in a world where people are indeed searching. And I hope people will go to that profile and get a bit more of your story because it's really awesome. Matthew, I think you were going to ask the next.
Yeah, Erica, your book, The Rights of Women, Reclaiming a Lost Vision, you go all the way back to the 18th century to tell the story of these early feminists and their approach to women's rights, which it seems to me is more humane than the many wrongheaded arguments for women's rights today. You focus especially, though, on the late 18th century English philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft. Her life was certainly rough, unconventional. She didn't necessarily reflect what she taught, but we know she had two affairs, one giving her a daughter out of wedlock, then she married the philosopher William Godwin, one of the forefathers of the anarchist movement, and with him she had a daughter, Mary Shelley. If that name sounds familiar to our audience, it's because she went on to become such an accomplished writer and the author of Frankenstein. Why rehabilitate Mary Wollstonecraft as you work for this new feminism? What does she offer us today?
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating things about Wollstonecraft is she's been kind of lionized and scorned for 200 years based on this biography that William Godwin wrote of her just after her birth, just after her death in Mary Shelley, with bearing Mary Shelley. She dies in childbirth. And, you know, now recently, over the last 30, 40 years, there's been much more, as women especially enter the academy, there's been much more sort of archival research about her actual life. some say that Godwin's biography of her was really an autobiography of himself. And so a lot of that has really shown that a lot of biographies that were done about her early on were just wrongheaded, kind of building upon error of her own life. Not to say that she, you know, wasn't both vulnerable and, you know, made mistakes. Certainly that's the case. But I think what's fascinating about her is, just how much she got right from a Catholic perspective with all of the sort of tragedy in her life. So I first read her as a women's studies student. I'd read really small excerpts of her, as most people do when they're, you know, studying sort of the Western canon. She comes up for her Vindication of the Rights of Women, her 1792 kind of major text. And then, you know, I never thought about her again, except for it later, much later, after doing my own legal scholarship around the abortion issue. So I've written quite a few law review articles around abortion jurisprudence. And I, having had a political theory background, I changed my major when I was at Middlebury from women's studies and sociology to political science and started studying political theory, both ancient and modern. And having had that background and having done these sort of deep dive into, say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's jurisprudence and thinking around abortion rights and this idea that abortion is necessary to women's equality, this kind of modern notion we have that we've seen play out really heavily after Dobbs, that women's rights, you know, necessarily demands abortion rights, all of this, I wanted to kind of get behind that thinking into the rights theory that underlie that. And what I knew as someone who had become pro-life over time was that the earliest, you know, American women's rights advocates in the 19th century were themselves pro-life. I knew that from, you know, having read a lot in Feminist for Life and all of that. So I wanted to get sort of go back to those women and see how they thought about rights. And so I did a lot of reading there, and they sent me back to Mary Wollstonecraft because they themselves had read her Vindication of the Rights of Women. So I went back and read the entire text, and I immediately was really drawn in. And so I went and read all of her texts and come to find, you know, in that she had all this early pedagogical work in which she was seeking, her very first book is on the education of our daughters, in which she was really seeking sort of to help form women, young women. So she had something called the Female Reader, where she excerpts scripture, Shakespeare, Milton, and it composes these four beautiful prayers herself. And all of this work was helping her, she has founded a girls' school herself. It was helping her to form or think about the moral and religious formation of girls, which as a mother was very close to my heart. I have four daughters. And so she just, the more and more I read of her, the more it didn't make sense of this kind of, you know, story that had been told of her.
Right.
And so then I got into the secondary literature and realized that all sorts of women had been rereading her, all sorts of women in the academy had started to see that actually she had all this theological insight, that she was oriented around virtue and really an older account of virtue, a Christian account of virtue, than anybody, you know. And so this new scholarship in the last 40 years has really uncovered a lot. And so my book, The Rights of Women, is really using her as a springboard to then give an account of that early women's rights movement, so that we can see kind of the broader and longer history of the cause of women's rights, and then see how the modern period, especially with the turn toward abortion rights and Roe v. Wade, is really like a disjuncture from that prior period. And not just with regard to abortion, but with regard to how they thought about, you know, the formation of children, marriage, parenting, you know, the differences between men and women, but also their equal dignity. And then how this kind of theologically informed, virtue-oriented approach underlie all of that. And to me, this is like really exciting stuff. And just the final thing about this is that for me, like, as an intellectual, as an academic, as a scholar, there's so much work to be done in this area, because what we've come to see is that a lot of that early feminist thinking, by feminist I mean just thinking about women's equal dignity and women's distinctive needs and interests. And so all of that, there's like all this memory pulling that happens where people didn't really like that. They had religious views. And so those earliest women in the academy, like in the 1970s, had a very revolutionary take and sort of pushed those to the side and really elevated women like, say, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had a very secular approach. And so in my book, I sort of show these two strains of thought and how they, you know, the religious one was much more influential, but then the other one ends up overtaking that. And that we have this capacity to, I think, at this point in history, you know, my subtitle says reclaim that original vision, that lost vision. So that's what a lot of my work is trying to do.
And I do love that. And one of the things I was so impressed in reading your work was just, it's not, it's pro-women, but it's not anti-man, as we see so much today. I mean, what Wollstonecraft was trying to do was to elevate virtue for both. But there was a lot to be understood about what women needed. And so, Erica, I'm thankful for your work. I'm going to point to your story at ncregister.com. This is a recent commentary you wrote, The Reason of Mary Wollstonecraft Championing Women and Their Moral Formation. There's another story that touches upon this, too. It's another commentary. People have differing views on where feminism fits today and how we should approach it as Catholics. This is another article we offer, Which Mary Should Catholic Women Follow, by Carrie Gress. But I am so grateful to have you on to explain this very important role that you're playing in your scholarship. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
When we come back, former U.S. Ambassador Samuel Brownback talks to us about the persecution of Christian Armenians. This is Register Radio on EWTN. Stay tuned for more.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, your host here on Register Radio. We turn now to a matter of international religious freedom. Armenian Christians are facing challenges to their existence by the Azerbaijan government. Our guest today, former Ambassador Samuel Brownback, served as Ambassador at Large for the International Religious Freedom from 2018 to 2021 for our country. Prior to that, he served as the governor of Kansas. He has recently called on the U.S. State Department to do more to help the Armenian Christians. Welcome, Ambassador Brownback, to Register Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure to join you. And thank you very much for covering this incredibly important topic where we can do some good, but there just doesn't seem to be that much interest or knowledge about it.
Right. Well, it's a part of the world that we don't know or don't follow too closely most of the time. But last year, there were tensions that heated up for ethnic Armenian Christians in a very small territory, Nagorno-Karabakh, and that's called by the Armenians, Artsakh. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but I'm trying.
Yes, you are. You've got it right. You're saying it right, and that's all accurate.
And this part of the territory is in the Caucasus Mountains, and that's in Eastern Europe, kind of very, very close to Western Asia. Can you remind people what happened last year that did catch the international community's attention?
You had 120,000 Christians forced out of their ancient homelands. And I'd remind people, Armenia is the oldest Christian nation on the planet. It became Christian in like the 300s and has been that ever since. But they sit there right in the eyes, and I say the bone in the throat of the Turks, who are Erdogan right now is a decided Islamist. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want them there, and they got run out by Azerbaijan, which is in many respects, a client state of Turkey. So that's what happened that got everybody's attention last year. They were first blockaded, starved, and then forced out. And now the concern is Armenia proper will be attacked by Azerbaijan and Turkey.
So there's just this constant expansion, and really you don't hear much about that. Of course, you know, the international community, when there were people starving because of a blockade, raised big alarm over that. But they don't seem to be raising as big of an alarm over this more existential crisis, which is they're trying to eradicate in many ways the Armenian Christians from the territory they have a claim to. And you have you're not the only one right now who's speaking out about this. The U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom, in their annual report, did call upon the State Department and Secretary Blinken to designate Azerbaijan as a country of particular concern. What does that mean exactly?
It means that they're one of the top violators of religious freedom around the world. It means that they're in this unusual category and a category you don't want to be in with North Korea and China, Iran, as a people that as a nation that highly persecutes people of the non-majority faith, or in China's case, they persecute everybody in all faiths. But that's a category you don't want to be in. Azerbaijan hasn't been in it previously, but now with their efforts to eradicate Christians in this area, they've gotten on that list.
So you've written in a recent Newsmax piece, this is the title of that piece, Brownback, State Department must act now on new Azerbaijan report. And of course, that's referring to this report from the U.S. Commission of International Religious Freedom. Has anything happened yet? This just came out in May.
Nothing has happened yet. And the reason I say that we must act is that this is one of those places in the world where the United States has some significant leverage that we can use and not have to go to war. We currently supply weaponry to Azerbaijan. We could stop doing that. That would put pressure on Azerbaijan. We could put economic pressure. Azerbaijan markets a bunch of its petroleum products, and I think they launder some of it coming from Russia through Azerbaijan into Europe and the Western world. We could blockade or threaten to blockade that, and that would stop the Azeris. And just for a little historical context here, too, the Armenian genocide happened in roughly 1915. You had 1 million Armenian Christians killed by then Ottoman Turks, Muslim Turks at that time, in the declining days of the Ottoman Empire. The United States Christian community stepped in then to help save a number of Armenians, and we need to step in now to save them again here 100 years later from another genocide.
It sounds like we should. So we're really grateful for the way that you are speaking up about this. You've been there. You've seen the territory and the area that we are talking about. We started the show talking about this blockade and the starving ethnic Armenians. Now that area that we were describing, you know, being kind of, they were holed up in, is practically a ghost town. Tell us more about this land, this territory that they lay claim to that's now deserted, and the ways that the Armenians are specifically being treated right now.
Well, they were blockaded by the Azeris. There was one road in that the Russians were supposed to make sure to keep it open. But Armenia had the temerity to go democratic, and that's one of the things you don't do to Russia, to Putin's Russia. So he walked away from Armenia and started siding with Azerbaijan. That then shut the supplies off to this Christian enclave. And it's a region that there's been challenges to who actually owns the land, but there's not been a challenge to the fact that the Armenians have lived in this land for literally thousands of years, that this has been a Christian enclave, a Christian area since 300 A.D. And that's who was just driven out, were those Christians in that area. And it is a ghost town region that the Azeris have forced. The bigger issue right now is we want to stop Azerbaijan and Turkey from invading Armenia proper, where there's no territorial question. But Azerbaijan is doing the Russian thing now, saying, well, Armenia really isn't a nation. They're just West Azerbaijan, like Russia says of Ukraine. It's not really a nation. It's just part of Russia.
Right.
And then they attack, and that's what we've got to stop.
This great aggression. And you have mentioned in your piece, your Newsmax piece, that other international communities have acted. Who's actually stepped in and started to help?
France, India have had good long-term relations with Armenia. They've stepped in to start to act and to help. Russia has stepped in, but in a bad way. They, for long periods of time, were the Armenian protectors. As fellow Orthodox Christians, the Russians had protected Armenia. But in a quick flip, they went to the side of the Azeris and have not protected, and that's really hurt then Armenia because of that. They've depended on Russia for centuries, really.
Mm-hmm.
And now that protection is gone because the Armenians went democratic and decided to stand for human rights, and that's something that Putin's Russia will not tolerate.
Right. Ambassador Brownback, you have worked in the international religious freedom arena now for many years, and you mentioned some of the other countries that we should be concerned about, these other countries that the U.S. Commission has cited. Are there any newer countries on that list that we should turn our attention to now?
You know, a newer one, and it's spreading, is Nigeria. Now,
right.
People have been noticing what's taking place there, but you've got really a jihadist convention happening in and around the region of Nigeria called the Sahel. That entire region is now catching on fire. Russia and China are stepping in to back the bad guys. Military governments are taking over. The Wagner Group is operating in that region. This is not good for religious freedom. This will lead to more religious persecution and war and people being moved and forced out of the region. That's really a key one that needs to be watched right now.
Well, Ambassador, we're very grateful for your work. We will keep our attention on the ethnic Armenians and what's happening with Azerbaijan. Just as you've said, we need to raise the awareness of the community about this. And I'm grateful for your push to the State Department as well. So thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. God bless you all.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. Together with Matthew Bunsen and today's producer, Michael McCall, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, may God bless you.
May is the month dedicated to the Blessed Mother. Pope St. John Paul II said, "Today we begin the month dedicated to Our Lady, a favorite of popular devotion." In accord with the long-standing tradition of devotion, parishes and families continue to make the month of May a Marian month, celebrating it with many devout liturgical, catechetical, and pastoral initiatives. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Join us in this devotion to the Blessed Mother with rosaries, books for children and adults, nativity sets, prayer cards, statues, and more. Available now at ewtnrc.com.